So thank you all for coming to my talk. So today I'll be talking about digital modeling and simulation, its role in computer science, and some of the work that I've done in this area. So this field has had immense success in the visual effects industry. When we go to theaters these days, it's so hard to tell what is real and what is not. And as technology has been continuously evolving, this field has even branched out of visual effects and is finding revolutionary new use cases for things such as virtual surgery. Surgeons actually perform a lot of interesting maneuvers to ensure that skin is in a state of least tension after medical procedure. And the availability of portable display devices now gives us the opportunity to design new and innovative training platforms for them. And in fact, the industry has already recognized this need, and new startups are constantly emerging in this discipline. So, as another example, autonomous driving cars are a very active area of research today. But to design robust controllers that can operate in challenging weather conditions, such as rain, or fog, or snow, we need tools that can efficiently simulate the external environment. So we all know that Google drives cars in California and has been logging hundreds of thousands of hours. But driving in more challenging situations, such as, say, Jersey, or where I happen to come from, like Wisconsin, where it typically snows a lot, it's a very different problem. So the industry is constantly working on this problem, and there are actually many startups that have emerged, and more keep emerging in this area. Now, apart from these two examples, simulation also has applications in robotics, in structural stability analysis, computational imaging, 3D fabrication, weather prediction, and so on. So my research looks at the underlying computational models, the associated data structures and numerical solvers, and how they interact with the underlying hardware to allow high quality simulations to run on commodity workstations. So just to give you a preview of what I can currently do, here is a simulation that has approximately 2 billion simulation variables, and it fits on a single computer. Here, I only have variables inside the bronchi, and there are approximately 2 billion of them. If you were to use standard methods to run these kinds of simulations, you would need over 13 terabytes of RAM and several months, if not years, of compute time. So this example is showing fluid flow in the human bronchi. And for the sake of visualization, I have colored the flow according to the vorticity or spin inside the flow. So red indicates low vorticity and blue indicates high vorticity. I'm also happy to share that this research was one of the highlights of the SIGGRAPH Asia conference last year and featured on the cover page of the proceedings that were published in the journal ACM Transactions on Graphics. So my ultimate goal through these kinds of techniques is to design a framework that allows computational dynamics to be delivered as a network service. So the key idea here is that there is a lightweight client that only sees the essential output, while there are dedicated servers on the back end that do all the heavy computation. And such a framework could either be used in the field or in online classroom environments for hosting virtual laboratories. The goal here is to allow individuals and even entire institutions to run these kinds of simulations without necessarily requiring the kinds of computational resources that are required for these kinds of tasks. So in this talk, I'll primarily talk about fluid simulation techniques. And broadly speaking, these techniques have two basic steps. They have an advection step that moves quantities forward in time, and they have a projection step that enforces incompressibility. Now, the exact nomenclature is not that important. What's important to understand is that the advection step requires streaming through the data and doing some local computation, such as interpolation. and the projection step requires solving a large and sparse linear system. Now, fluid simulations tend to be massive. For instance, if you are simulating the weather, or if you are trying to predict the effects of tsunami. So we need data structures that are efficient and can handle extremely large amounts of data. Also, these days, computing platforms are becoming increasingly heterogeneous as a price-efficient way to pack more compute power onto a single workstation. And in fact, you can actually buy a machine today that has 512 gigs of RAM and over 23 teraflops of compute power for less than $10,000. So in this talk, I'll talk about the design of efficient data structures and how to design efficient numerical solvers on these heterogeneous workstations. And I'll also go into some of the computational models that I've designed to simulate phenomena for which there were no good models before. So let me start with the design of efficient data structures. Now, typically, for simulation tasks, we require these data structures to be memory efficient and scalable to handle large amounts of data. And also, we want them to be cache optimized because most of the operations tend to be local. So we want to make full use of the available memory bandwidth. Now, unfortunately, most of the domains that arise in real-world applications tend to be highly irregular, like the human bronchi. And these pose obvious challenges in terms of exploiting parallelization and cache locality. So the industry has already recognized this need. And they have their own data structure called OpenVDB. And it was used for rendering massive cloud data sets in the movie Puss in Boots. And more recently, particle-based fluids in Battleship. So the data structure that I am going to talk about, which I call SPGrid, tends to be 5 to 10 times faster on two of the most typical operations that are encountered in fluid simulation. So what is SPGrid? It's a data structure that uses the virtual memory management system in conjunction with a Morton ordering scheme for efficient storage and processing of sparse data sets on uniform grids. So I designed this data structure with several goals in mind. First, I wanted fast sequential and local operation for efficiently handling the advection step. Second, I wanted the ability to store multiple data channels corresponding to different simulation variables, such as, say, density, pressure, velocities, temperature, and so on. And third, I wanted to make maximum use of the available hardware memory bandwidth. So to understand how SPGrid works, let's just consider a simple example. Suppose we have a giant domain, and we are only interested in a small region. Now the naive approach here is to just go ahead and instantiate a giant array on the entire domain. But we know from experience that if the size of the domain is too big, then we'll end up using a lot of memory, most of which will be wasted. So instead of following this paradigm, I follow a different paradigm where I use the mmap function call from the Unix environment. And this essentially reserves a large memory span. But this is only a placeholder, because only those entries, or voxels in this case, which are actually touched are stored in physical memory. And here, I'd like to point out a direct analog with the concept of virtual memory from the operating systems community. Essentially, the user sees a vast address space, but only those pages that are actually touched are stored in physical memory. And so there is a one-to-one correspondence between sparse datasets on uniform grids and the concept of virtual memory. So ideally, we would only like to store those voxels that are nearest our region of interest. And this brings up the question of how do you efficiently compute the address of any single voxel to perform a local operation, such as interpolation. So if we follow a lexicographic ordering, then a contiguous block in memory is going to correspond to a special strip of cells. And as you can see, we'll utilize only a small fraction of each 4 kilobyte page. What we want instead is something that looks more compact. And we can achieve this using a Morton ordering or a Z curve. And this is essentially a space filling curve that organizes data as compactly as possible. So SPGrid actually uses a hybrid ordering scheme where it organizes data into blocks, where elements within a block follow a lexicographic ordering, but blocks themselves follow a Morton ordering. So to understand the benefits of this hybrid indexing scheme, let's just look at four of these 4x4 blocks. And here I have just enumerated each voxel according to their index in this ordering scheme. So now, if you look at the binary expansion along the coordinate axes and one particular element, you can see that its index can be computed as a simple bit interleaving operation. And the catch here is that this operation can be performed extremely fast in hardware. So similar operations can also be used for efficiently computing the index of a neighbor for a voxel. So now that you understand how the data structure works, I want to point out that I have used this data structure to emulate adaptive data structures such as octrees. Now, these data structures conventionally follow tree-based representations and so have pointer-based implementations. And unfortunately, this makes them extremely slow because neighbor lookups correspond to explicit tree traversals which require expensive pointer dereferencing operations. So a typical rule of thumb is that for the same number of variables, an adaptive data structure is roughly 10 times slower than a uniform data structure. So instead of following this tree and pointer based implementation, I represent this quad tree as a stack of sparsely populated uniform grids. Now simply using this stack is not enough because neighbor lookups will still correspond to indirection up and down the stack and so will have similar problems as pointer based implementations. So another observation here was that typically in fluid simulation, we never require the answer at a single point in space. We require the answer for any kernel at all points in space. And so operations can be performed in bulk. And to efficiently handle this, I introduce the concept of Go cells. Go cells are essentially an alias for a cell that lives at a coarser level. And the idea here is to first upsample the value of the core cell into its ghost children, and subsequently perform operations only at a single level. And this will maximize our use of the available hardware memory bandwidth. So just to summarize, first we upsample the value of all core parents into their ghost children for any kernel. Subsequently, we perform operations only at a single level, and this will maximize our use of the available hardware memory bandwidth. And finally, we can downsample the value of the ghost children into its coarser parent. And it turns out that with these three operations as building blocks, we can emulate every kernel that arises in an adaptive fluid simulation pipeline.
So, Ridhu, quick question. Can you tell us a little bit? It sounds like you're saying that memory bandwidth is underutilized to some extent.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit more about some, you know, rough ballpark numbers and how bad a problem, I mean, how much is the underutilization and such?
Yes, so typically a workstation will have about 80 gigabits per second of memory bandwidth. If you are not careful, you may not even utilize 1/10 of that bandwidth.
And is that because the caches are doing a good job at blocking memory accesses, or like
it's because of the problem of how you have ordered your data.
Yeah.
So most of the operations in scientific computing are memory bound. You take one voxel, you look at its geometric neighbors. So I read one element, and I read its six neighbors in 3D. So I read seven elements in total. I perform some arithmetic operations, which may be like four additions and one subtraction, or six additions and one subtraction in this case. And then I'm going to write back a value again. So the number of reads and writes that I'm doing versus the number of arithmetic operations that I'm doing tends to be very large. And so it matters if you can make effective use of caches. The problem is that based on your ordering, some of your neighbors may be close by, others may be far apart. And so because you need to do the same computation at every point in space, you're constantly blowing cache lines all over the place.
And I mean, to these strides that you're sort of jumping all over, how big are they? I mean, do they go beyond these boundaries even?
It depends how you ordered your data. So if you follow lexicographic ordering, you will always blow a cache line whenever you access your neighbor in the other dimension.
And presumably cache prefetchers can't fix this problem. Mm,
they can't.
Because it's sort of
right. So you have prefetching issues and you have TLB misses also. And at some point, you are just hammering your system because you are waiting on the memory bandwidth instead of doing compute.
Last question. Have you played around with large pages to see whether there are TLB issues, 2 meg pages, 1 gig pages?
Yes, so that happens. And I have to ensure that the page size is enough, so like transparent huge pages, so that they don't become a bottleneck. Otherwise, they can become a bottleneck.
I have one more. When you do these ghost cells, are you using more memory because of that, since you're replicating the data to the ghosts?
Yes, but only slightly. Because any point in space lives at only one particular spatial location. Yeah. So you are using essentially a very low dimensional set to handle these ghost cells.
Because the motivation for the other thing, about the data organization, was because you have the circle and you have a page, mm-hmm. and you're using just a small subset of it. Once you do the ghost, mm-hmm. that thing still makes sense for?
Yes, because the biggest bottleneck here is your finest resolution. Anything that is not the finest resolution is basically upper bounded by the number of cells on the finest resolution. So if you create a low dimensional cell, it's non-trivial. Actually, it's trivial, not trivial. It's not trivial, it's trivial in terms of memory. Okay, so far I've described a framework that can efficiently store and process large amounts of data. Now, if you remember the projection step, we need to solve a large and sparse linear system. So we need an efficient solver for large amounts of data. So I used a multigrid solver, which is by far the state-of-the-art solver for solving these kinds of systems. As its name suggests, it's a multi-scale solver. It essentially has a hierarchy of discretizations at coarser scales to compute global corrections that are applied to the fine-scale solution. It has two building blocks. It has a smoothing routine that removes high-frequency noise, and it has a downsampling operator. And the way it works is that it selectively downsamples the problem until it can solve it exactly, and then it upsamples the solution. So one iteration of this V cycle corresponds to an approximate inverse of our operator. So just to see its benefits, let's just see a test problem. So this is an adaptive domain with three different scales, as you can see in the center. And our problem is applying a point impulse at this particular point. So this is the exact solution, and it looks like a tent function. So here is a different solver. Incomplete Cholesky preconditioned conjugate gradients, or ICPCG. This is by far the state of the art from an industrial standard. Industry uses this heavily because it's very easy to implement. But as you can see, it takes a long time to converge, because the waves of correction have to continuously propagate back and forth. So as opposed to this, multigrid solves the problem in roughly 10 iterations.
Is it as accurate as the previous salt or is the salt just showing the previous site? Is there any accuracy loss?
No.
Wait, is it downsampling?
Not at all. It's both are solving the exact same system, it's just a convergence issue. So the numerics are different on how the two solvers behave.
And is it theoretically proven that the two solvers
yes.
will
have? Theoretically, its complexity is linear. So if you followed multigrid to the dot, with n variables, you will solve it in on complexity. With ICPCG, it's on to the 4/3. So it's exponentially better. Okay, so with this solver in place, now we can run end-to-end simulations of smoke flow, as I show here. So this is an adaptive simulation where I have more resolution near the source and the sphere to capture all the interesting vortices. And there's less resolution away from the sphere because the flow is relatively stagnant over there. So this is what the adaptive grid looks like. It has 135 million voxels, and it fits on a single computer. To show the comparison of the two different solvers, the left example is using multigrid, and the right example is using incomplete Cholesky with a comparable compute time. And as you can see, multigrid is converging, so the flow on the left is relatively energetic, while the flow on the right is relatively sluggish because the solver is failing to converge. So instead of being incompressible, the right flow is actually compressible. Also, this framework can support dynamic adaptation of topology. So inside this box, there's 4 times higher resolution than everywhere else. And so this box can capture all the interesting vortices, but the flow is relatively damped everywhere else. So, just to conclude, I showed how virtual memory in conjunction with Morton ordering can be used to efficiently store and process large amounts of data and how it can be applied to emulate an adaptive smoke simulation pipeline. Now, I should mention that since this initial work, I have also extended this pipeline to work with liquids. And as you can see, this pipeline can efficiently capture lots of detail on the surface. And this example is using the following adaptive grid. But with this framework, we can also simulate fluid flow in very complex domains, such as a river canyon. And again, as you can see, this pipeline can produce lots of interesting surface detail. So for the sake of time, I'm not going into this extension. So far I have talked about the design of efficient data structures. Let me now come to efficient numerical solvers on heterogeneous platforms. But a question here is that I just told you that multigrid is by far the state of the art for solving these kinds of systems. So why do we need a new solver? Shouldn't multigrid just magically solve all our problems? So I will answer this question. Just please bear with me for the next few slides. Okay, so coming back to heterogeneous solvers, the motivation here is that bandwidth optimized accelerators, such as the NVIDIA GPUs or Intel Xeon Phi, are becoming increasingly price affordable. And now it's very possible to actually stash multiple such cards on a workstation to increase the compute power.
Is there anything particular with any feature or?
Well, NVIDIA has this CUDA framework that's very nice, okay. But it doesn't have virtual memory, which the Intel Xeon Phi has. So there are pros and cons.
You talk about GPUs. Would that apply for AMD GPUs as well?
Yes. The concepts that I'm going to describe are very general.
Are you going to be using, so wait, just to pick up on that, will you rely on having unified virtual memory between GPUs and something?
No, I don't rely on having unified virtual memory. But it is a research topic on how to efficiently write algorithmic kernels that give you the highest performance on, like, independent of the architecture.
Okay.
So for this example, I've had to manually hand tune kernels to give me good performance on like GPUs or yes. Yes, but it's a research question on how you can just automatically figure it out, like maybe having a good compiler or something in some way. But anyways, coming back to this thing, so these platforms are becoming increasingly common. Two examples are shown here, CPUs with multiple GPUs, or the newly released Intel Knights Landing framework that has a faster local RAM. So the fundamental challenge here is if we have a problem that is so big that it does not fit on the aggregate memory of your accelerators, then how do you organize computation so that you can benefit from the high memory capacity of CPUs? Because if the problem is too big to be hosted on the aggregate of your GPUs, then you have to host it on the CPU. And the CPU has way more memory capacity. So how can you benefit from high memory capacity of CPUs while benefiting from the high compute bandwidth of the GPUs? So to understand why this is a challenge, in a typical distributed setting, we only need to communicate boundary information between adjacent processors, right? And that's a low dimensional set, so everybody is happy. But if the entire problem is so big that it does not fit on the aggregate memory of your cards, then you have to communicate interior information as well. And if you look at the hardware specifications, the time it takes you to transfer the data onto the accelerators is way lower compared to the time it takes you to do some compute once the data is already there. And at that time, you may have been better off just solving the entire problem on the CPU itself. And this is the main problem why we cannot use a solver like Multigrid, because it's two building blocks, a smoothing routine and a downsampling operator. Both are memory bound operations. So most of the time, we are just waiting on memory transfers rather than doing any meaningful compute.
So what kind of links are you assuming? Is it like NVLink, or what's the link between the CPU?
Yeah, PCI Express.
PCI Express.
So given this challenge, my idea here is to pack more compute on the GPUs. And the hope is that by packing more computation on the GPUs, we will get better convergence, which in turn will hide the cost of the data transfers. So it's a very simple idea. Once the data is on the GPU, make it do more work. But how can we realize this into an efficient algorithmic framework? To make that happen, I turn to the theory of Schur complement methods from the scientific computing literature. So these kinds of methods work as follows. So we have a computational domain. We divide them through an interface that is typically just one voxel wide. Now first, we freeze the values on the interface to zero. And this essentially decouples the subdomains. And we can solve for them in parallel on all the available GPUs. Once we have computed these local solutions, we can use them to compute fluxes on the interface. Now these fluxes feed into a system that only has variables on the interface, and it is solved for on the CPU because this is a global problem and it's also unstructured to make full use of GPUs. So once we have solved this problem, we have the correct answer for the full problem only for the interface variables. So as a last step, we again freeze these values and do another round of local computation, which requires independent parallel solves on the independent subdomain. And these can be done on the GPUs. So once we have computed these solutions, we have computed the correct answer for our full problem. And our solver just proceeds as usual. So for the subdomains, we can use any of our favorite solver, like multigrid. So the real question here is, how can we efficiently solve the interface problem? And before I can answer this question, it's important to understand what is the nature of this operator. So this is just a 2D illustration. So the interface is highlighted in blue. The input to the operator is visualized as a set of vertical displacements. And the resulting force response is visualized as a color map. The way this operator works is that whenever the input changes, all the subdomains instantly come to equilibrium. So this is a quasi-static problem. And because the subdomains are at equilibrium at all points in time, the resulting force response is non-zero only at the interface, and that is the output of the operator. So its input is at the interface, its output is also at the interface. Everywhere else it's zero. So now that you understand its nature, let's look at its mathematical expression. So that's the form that it takes. Now the rightmost term here corresponds to when we freeze the values on the interface to do independent local computations. The term after that corresponds to solving the local systems themselves. And the term after that corresponds to computing fluxes on the interface. The leftmost term here just encodes the internal stiffness of the interface. So now that we see the system, there are actually several challenges associated with it. First of all, even computing this operator in explicit matrix form is very expensive because it requires inverting local systems. Second of all, even if you could somehow magically compute this operator, it's still going to be a dense matrix because its expression has dense inverses in them. And third, we need an efficient solver for this system because it's solved for on the CPU, and that may end up being the bottleneck of the entire pipeline if we are not careful. So, backing up a bit, essentially this is a divide and conquer algorithm where the divide part is cheap but the conquer part is super expensive. So to make this conquer feasible, I make an approximation that I will soon talk about. But by making this approximation, I have compromised the accuracy of the entire pipeline. So once I had already compromised the accuracy of the pipeline, I investigated if I could compromise anything else while not reducing the accuracy anymore. And it turns out that if we replace the exact subdomain solvers by a few iterations of a multigrid V-cycle, the resulting pipeline is way more parallel friendly, but the approximation guarantees are basically the same. So even though this pipeline is no longer an exact solver for our problem, it can still be used as a very efficient preconditioner to conjugate gradients, and that's how I use it. It's used as a preconditioner for conjugate gradients, not as a direct solver. So going back to this slide, to efficiently solve this system, I designed a multigrid solver because all the preconditions that need to be satisfied in order for multigrid to be applied actually hold in this case. And that just follows from the theory of Schur complement methods. So multigrid has two basic building blocks. It has a smoothing routine and it has a downsampling operator. So it requires a hierarchy. So let's just look at the hierarchy. So here I just use the obvious approach where I removed every other variable at the coarser level. So the hierarchy is pretty straightforward. So let's look at the smoothing routine. So here I've just written the interface equation. And here I've just expanded the expression of the interface operator. Now if you rearrange the terms, you will get this expression. And this expression can be converted into an iterative scheme. The key realization here is that you never need to compute this operator in explicit matrix form. You only need to compute its action on an input vector. And so this entire smoother can be applied in a matrix-free fashion. So that gives us some benefit. And to further reduce the complexity of this smoother, because it runs on the CPU, I make an approximation where I replace the inverse in this expression by a different matrix. So to understand the intuition behind that last step, let's just go back to the analytic solution for a point impulse. So if you remember from before, the analytic solution looks like a tent function. So in this domain, I've just highlighted the interface. So that is shown by these extremely thin dark blue lines. So if you remember, the input to the interface operator only lives on the interface, and the output again only lives on the interface. So we will have these point impulses only at the interface. And given the nature of this solution, it becomes increasingly smooth as soon as you move away from the interface. And so the idea here is to not use full resolution, but use an adaptive resolution. And it turns out that if you use an adaptive resolution, you have decreased the number of variables, and the resulting response still looks very similar. So to appreciate that, I can just toggle between the two slides. It's not exactly the same, but it's very close. So what this is essentially saying is that it does not matter what we do inside the subdomains. It only matters what we do near the interface, and that's the output of the operator. So that's the intuition. Let's just see how robust it is in practice. So on a 2D example, I'm doing the computationally most infeasible thing. I'm solving all the subdomains exactly, and I'm solving the interface problem, the exact interface problem exactly. So there are three quantifiers here. All the subdomains are exact, and the exact interface solver is being solved exactly. So if you do that, the theory says that your solver should just converge in one iteration. And that's what we are seeing here. So just want to point out that this solver is still being used as a preconditioner for conjugate gradients. But because we are doing everything exactly, it just converges in one iteration. Now, I'm going to replace the exact subdomain solver by three iterations of a multigrid V cycle. And now we see that this solver converges in roughly 10 iterations. Now what I'm going to do is replace the exact interface solver by my adaptive approximation. Yes. So the exact interface solver is solved by my adaptive approximation, but this system is still being solved exactly. So we see that this system or this solver still converges in 10 iterations. And now if we replace this exact solver by my multigrid solver, which is the proposed method, then the resulting system is still converging in 10 iterations. Now just for comparison, I also show multigrid preconditioned CG, and we see that it is also converging in 10 iterations. So what this is basically showing is that this example is not sufficient to highlight the benefits. But one thing that I want to point out is that my method is running in a distributed setting, while multigrid is running homogeneously on a single CPU. So let's look at this is just ICPCG, and we have seen this behavior before, that it takes a long time to converge. So that's just for completeness. So in a more complex example, the proposed method takes roughly 14 iterations to converge. Now in this example, multigrid takes twice as many iterations to converge, because it is not able to approximate the correct solution at coarser levels, and so it starts making errors. and that's why it's taking more iterations to converge. Now on this complex domain, incomplete Cholesky preconditioned CG will just take forever to converge. So here we only show 300 iterations and it just moves a tiny bit. So here is a 3D example where a source is pouring water in a domain with multiple thin walls, and that is causing the flow to meander around them, creating interesting flow patterns. So on this example, we are just taking one frame and we are highlighting the residual with colors. Brighter color indicates large residuals and darker color represents small residuals. And so ICPCG is still taking lots of iterations to converge. Multigrid takes about 17 iterations to reduce residual by 5 orders of magnitude. And my solver does the same thing in 8 iterations. Now coming to the bronchi example, this is my solver and it reduces residual. This is not my solver, this is multigrid. And this is taking lots of iterations to converge on this problem. Because this is just so irregular that solutions at coarser scales are not a good approximation for the correct solution at the finer scale. And so ends up taking lots of iterations, more than 50. On this problem, my solver can solve it in 10 iterations. Yeah.
I have a question. Is there a ground truth for the converged result? Like, for example, if yours takes 17 iterations to converge to something, and then the other method takes like 300 iterations to converge to something else, did you compare like the final converged result?
Both will compare to the same, converge to the same thing.
Okay, so there's a ground truth whether it converged to the right result.
Right. The only thing that we are measuring is how long it takes to converge. So what we are seeing is that my solver is taking less iterations to converge, and it is also running in a distributed setting, and it is outperforming the state of the art that cannot run on a distributed setting. So that is running on a single CPU.
Okay, I see.
And are those iterations comparable?
In terms of compute time?
Yeah.
I'll show timings. So just before we go to timings, here is another example, which is showing smoke flow in a domain with multiple twisted tubes. And these tubes are causing the smoke to churn, creating interesting vortical detail. So here again, I've colored the smoke according to the vorticity of the flow field. Blue indicates high vorticity, and red indicates low vorticity. So this example has 1.2 billion voxels. Again, fits on a single computer. So for the sake of timing, I'm going to call this example sieve. And we have already seen the bronchi example that I'm just going to call lungs. So in terms of timings, there are two important numbers to look at. There's the total solve time. And we can see that my solver is roughly 3 to 5 times faster than multigrid. And if you look at the per iteration cost, we see that it is comparable, but my solver is taking slightly longer. And that makes sense because we are packing more computation on the GPUs per iteration. And there is some cost associated with the data transfer. So the per iteration cost comes out to be a little bit higher. So to conclude here, I showed how the theory of Schur complement methods can be used to design a very potent solver that can run on heterogeneous compute platforms. Now, I just want to mention that here I only showed fluid flow in static bronchi, but I'm interested in extending this technique to model human respiration, and that poses unique challenges on how to model fluid structure interaction with thin deformable walls. And the same pipeline can actually also be used for simulating cardiovascular flow. More generally, I'm also interested in the problem of biomechanics. And these kinds of methods will not only enhance our understanding of how the human body works, but it can also predict failure modes after medical procedures, not short term, but even long term. And sadly, there are no such methods to predict the outcome of medical procedures, say after 5 years or 10 years, and so on. As you can see, I've already started doing some preliminary work in this direction. That's ongoing collaboration with Seoul National University, South Korea. Okay. So that concludes the design of efficient solvers for fluid flows on heterogeneous platforms. Now, in both the first two topics, I was either talking about the design of efficient data structures or how to design efficient solvers, but I was not changing the underlying matrix that I was solving, or the model. And this model was established by my friends in mechanical engineering. Now, sometimes it happens that there are no established models for the problem that we are trying to simulate. And so occasionally, I also venture into designing the accurate physical model. And so I'm just going to give one example in that area in the context of bubble dynamics. So bubble dynamics tend to be very interesting from an aesthetic perspective because of the large amounts of detail that they exhibit at various scales. But more importantly, they have been finding increased attention for designing non-invasive medical technologies. So the key idea here is that when we inject a bubble into the human body and we subject it to an ultrasound wave of high enough frequency, then it disintegrates into daughter bubbles, releasing secondary shock waves. And these shock waves can be used for different applications, such as kidney stone destruction, or prostate tumor ablation, or targeted drug delivery. So the key factor at play here is the ability of air to expand and contract to release these shock waves.
And how do you remove the bubble? You put some air.
Yes.
And you play around. And then how do you remove the air afterwards?
You can either disintegrate it or you can just disintegrate it. So apart from these, many phenomena that we commonly observe in nature only occur because of the ability of air to expand and contract in volume. So in this water dispenser, what's actually happening is that as water exits the spout, there's a pressure drop up top. And so some of the air entrains from below to form bubbles, something that we see very commonly. But if your solver cannot simulate compressibility of air, then it won't be able to simulate a water dispenser. And unfortunately, most of the methods that exist within the engineering literature do not model the compressibility of air. So they can't simulate a water dispenser. So I first designed a method that could simulate the compressibility of air. And the key idea here is to conserve the mass of air instead of conserving the volume, which corresponds to just modeling it as incompressible throughout. So rather than just conserve mass of air, I first solved the more general problem of enforcing discrete conservation laws, which include conservation of mass, momentum, and energy. Now, while these principles are an integral part of the continuous governing equations, they are not discretely enforced. And if you try simulating without them, you can get visual artifacts, as we see on the left. But if we enforce these conservation laws, we can preserve better visual detail. And they also have independent applications, such as modeling this perceptual motion field, as we see on the right. The flow is energy conserving. So simply enforcing discrete conservation laws is not enough, because we also need a technique to efficiently solve for the pressure inside the water and air, where the air is compressible. And so for this, I considered the more general problem of coupling materials like water to fully non-linear compressible flow that includes the effects of shocks and rarefactions. So on the left, we are seeing an example where there's a water drop that is moving with a high velocity inside a compressible gas. And so it is generating a shock wave in front of it and a rarefaction wave behind it. The right has nothing to do with bubble dynamics, but that is just showing what a moving shock wave looks like in reality. And because the left has a static image, I thought that video would actually be more informative. So once I had solved this problem, I made some simplifications that both the density and the pressure in the air are spatially constant. And that's just because internal nonlinearities don't matter all that much for bubble dynamics. So in matrix terms, what this means is that all the entries corresponding to a bubble get collapsed into a single row and a single column. And so our matrix remains basically the same, but every bubble now has a dense row and a dense column. But with that model, the resulting solver is extremely robust in its ability to capture multiple bubbles with merging and pinching, as you see here. And I just want to mention that this is just demonstrating the efficacy from a visual perspective, but I have actually quantified the accuracy of this model on various analytic problems and showed that it actually converges to the exact answer. And I've also simulated what's the effect on a real world problem. So this example is comparing the dynamics to a single bubble that is rising vertically in a liquid of pre-specified surface tension and viscosity coefficients. And what this model is showing is that it can very accurately capture the steady state shapes. So the right image is high-speed photography. And it can also very accurately predict the steady-state rise speed. Now, when it comes to small-scale dynamics, like the streamlines of the velocity field, then it diverges because of a highly simplified single-pressure degree of freedom model inside the bubble. And so it cannot capture vortices inside the bubble. In terms of compute time, this is the standard approach in engineering for solving these kinds of systems, which does not model the compressibility of air. And this is my method. And as you can see, my method can capture compressibility of air, and it is 6 times faster. So while this method just works very nicely, it cannot capture bubbles that become smaller than the size of a single voxel in your simulation grid. And so I had to extend this method to capture this small scale detail, as you see on the right. So the basic idea here was that I selectively coarsen the background simulation grid, averaging equations in the process. Ultimately, the bubble becomes smaller than the size of a single voxel in the simulation grid, but it is still coupled to the background flow because of this averaging. And here I'm just showing the size of the bubbles that this model can stably handle with reference to the size of a single grid cell. And the model remains stable even when the size of the bubble becomes larger than the size of a single voxel. So this example is showing complex object interaction. Here the motion of this armadillo is pre-scripted, so it constantly keeps up and down. But we can see that we can capture all the interactions that happen with the bubbles as they are rising from the source. Also, just for visual perspectives, I also generalized this model to simulate bubble generation near complex fluid structure interactions. So in reality, what happens here is that as these interfaces slice through the water, there's an instantaneous pressure drop. And so some of the water instantly vaporizes to form bubbles through a phenomenon called cavitation. Now, I'm not modeling the full-scale physics there. What I'm just showing is that a simplified model can still predict where bubbles are generated. And so it can reproduce patterns that we see in real life. That actually happens. The flow actually looks like this. It's called a von Karman vortex tree. So just to conclude, I showed how we can construct a model to model the compressibility of air and use this model to efficiently capture both large and small scale detail. Now here I just want to mention that while my focus was on modeling air and water interactions, similar challenges arise when modeling fuel spray in engine design, or blood flow in the human body, or even complex terrain mechanics. And so these are all problems that I'm interested to look at in the future. And of course, I want to go back to the initial motivation for this problem, which was to simulate bubble interactions with ultrasound waves for medical applications. So to conclude, what I've basically shown is that if we pay close attention to the underlying computational models, the associated data structures and numerical solvers, and how they interact with the underlying hardware, we can go significantly beyond the state of the art to allow high quality simulations to run on commodity workstations. So I just want to mention that I'm also actively packaging all my simulation software into a library that I plan to release as open source. And this will have all the state-of-the-art solvers that I just described. So with that, I'd just like to acknowledge the funding sources that made this work possible, both to the Stanford and Wisconsin Graphics Lab that provided a very nice environment, to all my co-authors, as well as my PhD and postdoc supervisors for their mentorship. And with that, I thank you for all your time, and I'm happy to take any questions.
There's been some recent work in deep learning where people are using Octree to like more efficiently compute 3D, you know, 3D convolutions and such that like have a reduced memory footprint. Mm-hmm. Can you speak to how any of your methods might have an impact in that area?
So this method has full applicability to such problems. Because the local convolutions are exactly similar to the kinds of operations that I was talking about.
Uh-huh.
So if somebody is interested, I would be very interested to look at that extension.
Okay.
Cool. Any other questions? Looks like we maybe got a bunch during the talk. So okay, let's just thank the speaker again.